Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Thriving with Sarah and Jenny. Anyone who's been joining us for a few years now will, I hope, be as delighted as we are to welcome back Jeppe Hansgaard, CEO of Innovisor. And Jeppe, you've come back because you're just published a book. You're about to publish a second book, so not just one, but yes, two. And we wanted to talk about it. I think last time we talked about the work that you do and everything, but this is just really crystallized and formalized. The conversation we had, I think, has a real process that people can follow. I ate it up. It's so useful. It's so practical. It's got great stories. So welcome and thank you for joining us again.
It's wonderful to join again. You are my all-time favorite podcast host. So it's out to you immediately. The last time I was on, I really enjoyed the conversation. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I had an absolutely fantastic time. It's definitely my favorite conversation, I think, that we've had. So I was thinking, because this is the thing that made me, I think, initially just really attracted to your story and what you talk about. For anyone who's new to the conversation with you, can you just give us a reminder of the 3% rule, which I think is like, you know, of everything, the thing that people need to understand.
Yes. Yeah. So the 3% rule is something we stumbled upon in our work over the years when people asked us, or leaders asked us, who is it that we should engage to maximize our impact in an organization? And to answer that question, we looked at the informal networks. Who was it that people reached out to for help and advice? Who was it that energized them? Who was it that trusted? Etc. And we found those people in all the small cliques and groups and tribes around in the organization, right? But then to maximize it, we looked at a different thing. We looked at, okay, so what is the minimum number of people we need to engage to get the maximum impact? Which almost like, if you look at like as a puzzle, right? So okay, we got this tribe covered. Now I need a person in another tribe and so forth, right? It's almost like a puzzle where you make sure you make the puzzle with the fewest number of puzzles, basically, right? And what we realized was that if we just found the right 3% of the people distributed across the organization, then collectively they had an impact on the rest of the organization, actually on about 90% of the organization. So not 100%. And then just to make sure that I emphasize this, it's not 100%, because if I had to reach 100%, I would need to engage with the people one by one in the last 10%. It's because there's no person really that really has a big impact on them anymore. But the 3% can get to the 90%. And that's a pretty marvelous number when you think about what leadership can get to, because leaders, which is at least in our numbers, is typically around 12% of the population, they only get to 40 to 50%. Wow. So, I mean, if you run a change program top down, you're going to miss it, right? It's like rolling the dice and there's a 50% chance that you're succeeding or not, right? And that's the thing.
Yeah.
And then that has kind of led me to the book, right? I think there's no way around change. You have to, and I'd always say done by the people or done with the people would always be done to the people. Yeah. And that's the thing I'm working on, right? I want to make sure as many people as possible know that.
It's fantastic. And I think it's so impactful, that 3%, because if you didn't have all the data and statistics to back it up, I think like as a leader or someone who's been a leader, I'd be like, that just can't be right. That's not possible. You know, like it's so outrageously impactful, that small number of people. I just think it's fantastic. So the book, The Change Fiasco, how did it come about?
Now, this is another fun story, right? 8-9 years ago, I was told by a mentor, Jeppe, you need to write a book. You need to be the thought leader of Innovisor. You need to get out there speaking and write articles, all of that stuff, right? I kind of did all of that except the book. I just couldn't do it. I mean, it was too much of an effort really for me, right? And then truth be told, I even had the structure of the book in my C drives, with chapter names and all of that stuff, and with stuff put into it. All of it was lying there, right? And then September 15, very exact day here, right? I was reading a tweet in the evening and it said, well, this is simple. You should just activate your assets, your written assets, and then generate income. I thought, That sounds interesting. I don't really want to generate income. That's not why I'm doing it. I want to generate the credibility and the context. But the advice was three things, right? Find a ghostwriter on Fiverr, which is a tool. I don't know that tool, right? And I had been talking to ghostwriters forever, really, right? Because maybe not. Anyway, so that was the first thing. Create a front page on Canva. That's the second thing. That sounds easy, right? Okay, so one thing. And then third thing was sell it on Gumroad. I've never heard about Gumroad, but okay, that sounds funny. So I take a picture of the tweet and I send it to the Innovizer team. I said, we need to talk about this on Monday. Then Monday morning at 9 o'clock, we do the usual check-in and stuff. And then I said, well, that tweet I sent to you, what do you think about that? And then they said, yeah, but it's all good, but nobody can write your book. I mean, they're never going to be able to tell your stories or hit your voice. So you have to write yourself. See, and this was now September 18, right? I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I know I should write that book, but I've never been able to do it. So what do I do? And then I decide, okay, now let's see if I just put some pressure on myself. I knew I was going to France on September 30, which was my birthday. And I had a few days there because we just bought a summer house in France, right? So I actually said, okay, I promise you, by October 5, the book will be done.
Wow.
So you have September 18 to October 5, right? That's a very short period of time. So, and then just to kind of increase the pressure, I tweeted about it. Nothing really happened. Anyways, when really then put the real pressure on was that then we were starting to play with front pages and stuff in Canva. We had four different front pages. We decided for a yellow one. Then we thought, okay, we also need to make sure we do something on this Gumroad thing, the platform where we're supposed to celebrate. So we put out the yellow one and said, okay, you can pre-order now. And that's the only thing we did. Now we are September 20. I've not written a single chapter yet. But then someone bought it. That's the pressure, right? So then I knew, okay, I have to write this book now. Somebody actually paid.
I love that. So you're literally accountable to one person.
Yeah.
And you wrote the book. I love that.
No, so then we took pre-orders and that kind of accelerated. So it has been sold in more than 25 countries by now. The fun story about the second book is, remember I said we had a yellow front cover and we also had the blue cover, right? And I thought, okay, now we have a blue cover. Why don't we use it for something? So on the day before we released the first book, I said, so what do we call the second book? And then we were kind of brainstorming on the title for the second book. And then when we released it, we said, well, there's going to be a second book. It's called Connectivity is Broken.
Love it.
Yeah. And then, of course, on the first day, somebody's reordering, right? So the pressure was really on. So I'm writing it right now. And it will be, I hope, released early January.
Fantastic. Yeah. But I mean, kudos to you. Most authors struggle with their book writing, says she who is currently struggling with her book writing for many months. And I think what's wonderful about your story is that you already had the book there. It was ready to go because the biggest part of the book writing is really getting the structure right first, knowing what the content is. And you had that all mapped out on your C drive. Yeah. That was there just sitting, waiting for you. And then it was like, okay, now we're ready. Now we can go. This story of one pre-order leads you to write the book. I just maybe I should try that as well. What do you think, Sarah?
It puts the pressure on, right? So I had a lot of articles, right? So I could just put it in, right? I had more than 150 LinkedIn posts. So I guess I can find something where every chapter.
But I think that probably reflects your nature too, because, you know, your company, your reason for being Innovizer is coming up with doing things differently. And you've certainly done that this time. And I think with the 3% rule, where you have not, you know, traditional change management off the pitch completely, because we were all brought up with Kotter's 7 steps or however many steps it was. And, you know, with the knowledge that most change management strategies were complete duds, were guaranteed to fail. And you think, well, why bother? So the fact that you have sort of isolated this way of leading effective change is revolutionary. And I just applaud you for that. It's just fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. Love it. So I'd like to invite you to talk about a few of the things in the book, if you would. Obviously, the power of informal networks, right? Yeah. So how did you discover this? What led you to being able to go, thinking in this way completely differently to how we have traditionally thought?
Yeah, and I think I have a background as a change management consultant, as many people have, right? And I constantly got puzzled about the stakeholder assistant, right, never really seemed to identify those people that really could make or break the change. Those informal leaders, right, if they didn't really buy into it, if they didn't support it, or if they didn't whatever, then we would never succeed, right? And I was just thinking about it this morning. I had this one story. This story is not in the book, I should say. But this story about a merger between six different companies, which were, I was heading a sub project in that change program. It was six different companies. We had 18 different nationalities in it. And it was an awful project. I mean, it was a project where we had real sabotage going on. I mean, with the screwdrivers into IT servers and stuff like that, right? And then suddenly a CEO came about. And this new CEO, right, which was brought in from another country, was really like this fear-based manager. And he kind of just terminated people, left them right whenever there was somebody they didn't like because of their hair or maybe their shirt or whatever, right? It was an awful experience, right? And that led me to think about, okay, these informal structures, right? Who is it that I need to make sure will be on my team to win change? And that's something I puzzled with for a long time. Then one day, and I know the exact day, December 13th, 2005, I was attending a masterclass in London with a professor from Henley Business School. I really owe her. I've actually said thank you to her afterwards as well, right? So she presented a slide which showed the formal organization and then the informal organization, right? And in the informal organization, you had people that apparently mattered much more than some of the formal leaders, right? And that led me to really try to understand this thing about the informal organization, the informal networks, how they really look and how they can change stuff. I think one of the important things is this, is the understanding of that emotions actually flow through relationships. So your commitment to something has got nothing to do with the stars on your shoulder or somebody. It has got something to do with the emotions that flow between people. And if the right people, the right 3% of people, they are positive around whatever you're doing, and then I see it as an early warning signal for your change program, then they will convince everybody else. And in the book, I talk about this case of a media company. It's actually the final chapter in the book. The media company that I think they had the worst ENPS score that I've ever seen, minus 48. I mean, minus 48, I cannot imagine how it must be to work for a company like that. But,
I don't know if anyone still did work for them yet, but so bad.
So this was a company that totally missed the boat on digital media, right? So they were staying with print media.
Wow.
And then, you know, digital media, haven't got the internet, we got all of these things happening, right? So they totally missed the boat on that. And we then started to work with them. We identified the catalyst, the 3% in the organization that they needed to work with. They were really good at activating them, listening to them. They even engaged them as co-creators and in some cases, actually owners of the new digital media projects that they were working on. And within 1 year, they actually managed to improve the ENPS score to plus 28. So an improvement of, 76 points in 1 year. That is the most insane turnaround that I've ever seen. And it was only possible because they did it with the people. Rather than starting to figure out, okay, we need something top down, or we need an expensive outside digital consulting company to come and help us. They had all the capabilities. They just needed to change the way they worked.
That's such an interesting story, Jeppe. And as soon as you started sharing it, it took me back to Kodak.
Yes.
Because they had a very similar experience. You know, they actually designed the thought of digital photos, but then didn't on it. I don't know
what was going on within their organization, but clearly they were trying to do it the traditional way, or leaders telling people what to do or not to do. And then we lost that Kodak moment forever. And I'm thinking, gosh, if they had known about the 3%, maybe it would have been a different outcome. We shall never know. But I just thought, whoa. I mean, to go from such a poor position to such a more positive position in such a short time frame, that's
We actually show the curve, because we checked the eNPS every 6 months in the book, right, to see if we made progress or not. And it's an incredible journey. It is an incredible journey.
Wow.
You also got the other story. So there is this story that I think I mentioned to you before. It's a U.S. manufacturing company, and we're working with HR here. They have 500 people in a global organization. And we started to talk about who are these influencers, how their impact on everybody else, including that if they quit, and quitting can become contagious, because, I mean, these really likable people, if they move on, or if you terminate them, as they did in this case, then it really goes wrong, right? So in this case, we have this visualization of the influence networks, and it's so clear there's one person where everybody from the entire world, they kind of connect to her, right? And her name is Gloria. And the senior vice president of HR, so our sponsor here, right? She's sitting there and she's asking the question that I kind of anticipated that she would ask. So who is that person? It didn't say Gloria on the visualization. So I looked down on my piece of paper and said, it is Gloria so-and-so. And she doesn't know her, right? So that's the first thing. They would know them, really, right? So she looks Gloria up on their company intranet, or the phone book, or whatever they call it. And then suddenly you just see her face turn pale, and then the head just terminated, Gloria.
Wow.
And then you just know, okay, so they're going to be in for a hard ride, right? So because the informal positions of people are just not visible to leaders. You can't see them. I sometimes do a small questioning where I ask people, so how many people do you know where you really know what drives their behavior, right? And most people come up with an answer like a handful or something. If you say more than that, then I'm going to tell you a bit about how brain capacity works and Dunbar, the rule of Dunbar and all of that stuff. Anyways, so five people, right? And then you say, okay, so if you know those five people, how well do you know the people they are connected to, the ones where they know what is happening, right? So let's say it's another five people. Then now you multiply five with five, you got 25. So that's probably the maximum you can see out in an organization. You cannot see further out. And I know some people will think they can see 5,000 people out or whatever to see who are the most influential. They can't. And I can tell you, when we look at our numbers, the number is 22, not 25. It's 22.
22 people.
So that's what you can see. And if you can just acknowledge that you don't know, then I think we already do good.
Because then you start by being open. So a question came up for me while you were talking, and it was linked to the story of the Frenchman in the book, right?
Yeah.
And it's because you found him twice. Is that right?
I didn't find him the other time, but yes, the person I talked to said, I know who that is.
You know that, yes. Right. So who do you foster or hire, or is it totally accidental? In all of your experience, if you were looking to hire, and you wouldn't, I'm sure, want to hire all of these people because there's varying degrees of people, but how can you make sure you have enough of those people in your organization?
I think in any network, you will always have 3%. I think it's a human construct of how we connect to each other. I don't think it's about hiring. That's just not the way it works in networks. Some people will have more influence. That's the way it is. And some people will have less. I think the important thing in networks, and that's really what my second book is about, is that, okay, you can actually lose the connectivity between people. Mm-hmm. So the power of your networks shrinks. And that's the reason for the second book, because what I can see is that a lot of people are now dropping out of the networks, the informal networks. We see about 25% of people not being included in networks. And what that means is that they're not being reached out to for help and advice. They're not being reached out to for social chit chat and so on. That is a lonely place, and it really has an impact on your well-being as well. So that's really what number two book is about, the connectivity that is broken inside organizations. But if you just look at a network, then we see the 3% reappearing. I mean, it doesn't matter if we're looking at an ecosystem We analyzed a big ecosystem in California for economical development. It was organizations, it was universities, it was engineers, and all of that stuff. When you look at that network between those people, it was 3% again. Then I do in my local track and field club, right? We are now 200 people or something like that. The 3% is there as well. Wow. Or if you look at, and we are involved in another case here in the United Kingdom, where it's about activating people to move more, and you see 3% again. So I think it is a human construct of how we connect to each other.
It's amazing.
So just to answer your question, so I don't think you can recruit yourself to a...
No, I was going to say, so that leads to my next question, which is like, it sounds like they can be different because you've got the kind of quadrant in the book and, you know, there's certain personality. They're actually more likely to be introverts rather than extroverts type thing. But are there, not skills, but like maybe attitudes is the right word, that you would lean towards hiring in an organization that challenge maybe the status quo? Like maybe they're not the best.
So I think there are a couple of things that I would look for if I was to hire people in this. And then I don't remember if this quarter, 2x2. I'm in love with 2x2, right? So I just throw them in there. I'm sorry. But I have this 2x2 that I have adopted from a very good article called Competent Nerds, Lovable Tools, and the Formation of Social Networks. And what it really tells you is that you've got sympathetic on one side, unsympathetic on the other side, and then you got competent at the top and less competent at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned is that in networks, being sympathetic beats being competent. So if you hire people that are highly competent but not sympathetic, you're not going to be able to harvest the value from their expertise. Yeah. Because people are just not going to work with them.
Yeah.
You really need to hire for people that will be part of the network. I'm not saying it has to be the same title. I'm just saying there has to be some kind of thing that can create a relationship between people. And if there isn't, then you're going to have a hard time with that person. And you know as well as I do, some people are just not so kind, right? Also nice.
It doesn't work well with others.
Well, that's actually this thing that I'm talking about right now. You know, NASA is looking at teams because they want to go to Mars, right? If you want to go to Mars, the team you want to go to Mars with should not only be experts. That's okay when you go to the moon, right? Because that takes a week and then you're back again, right? But if you want to go to Mars, the period is so long, so you actually need a different breed of people. You need people that are actually, they call them almost clowns, right? But people that can back a jaw, make fun, make sure that any tension is eased and so forth. It's a different breed of people. And if you think about it, what we do in organizations is more like going to Mars than going to the moons. And we have to remember that, right? That has an impact on who you should be working with.
I love that.
Because the other thing that you're highlighting here, Jeppe, is the fact that people can learn new skills. They can increase their level of competency. But to try and teach somebody how to be more sympathetic, especially when they don't see that it's an issue for them, is going to be a challenge. So I think it's about recognizing that the human traits of connection trump knowledge, because knowledge is something that can be gathered and improved on. And again, I guess with the flight to Mars, I'm not volunteering, by the way.
No, me either.
They say that when the rocket ship takes off, it'll only be a short period of time when they're on their way to Mars that the changes and improvements in the technology and everything will have grown so much that people will have to take on those new skill sets. So you want a team that can actually do that.
Yes.
As the rocket ship gets closer and closer to its final destination. And I guess any organization is always looking to encourage their employees to step up and gain mastery and greater competency. So I think that's...
Then you get into all of this thing where you need to have value-added conflicts, right? Because there will be tensions. Oh, but as long as your tensions will lead to something and you don't...
So interesting. Can I pick you up on something else you mentioned? You were just sort of leading into the second book, which is coming out next year. And you mentioned something about, was it 25 or 22% drop in the level of social, informal social networking? What is...
Yeah, no, so
is
the 25% that have dropped out of the informal networks inside organizations. And I have to say that prior to the pandemic, it was only 5% that we saw that were hanging in the periphery. So what happened during the pandemic was that most of us, we made a good effort in retaining our connections to the people we knew well. But all of those ones in the periphery, right, they got lost. And even today, I mean, the pandemic is over. We have hybrid work schedules, etc. People in the periphery, they're forgotten. And they're sitting out there and they are lost. And so we had one case which we're looking at where we measured it over time. And we could actually see those people sitting in the periphery, right, that nobody reaches out to. The next time we assessed it, 79% of them have left. So if you really want to take it serious that you want to retain people in a time where there's a lot of fluctuations,
yeah,
you need to think about the relationships.
Definitely. Wow. I mean, that's massive, isn't it? Was it a quarter of the people or a quarter reduction of social networks? But to lose that...
It's actually 25% of the people.
Wow.
Organizations can't afford that level of turnover.
It has an impact on performance, on everything, well-being, engagement, whatever you want to do. That's where it really hurts.
Mm. Do you think the working remotely has also contributed to this, where people have elected to stay at home and not go back into the office? Is that part of the change that's occurred?
So we did a hybrid work study earlier this year, where we had 6 organizations and 2,000 people in our data foundations there. We wanted to look at what is it that people should do to create high-performing hybrid organizations, right? So the first hypothesis would be you are better connected if you're in the office 5 days per week. That could be a hypothesis, right? That's just not the case. The people that are in the office 5 days per week are probably more part of the office furniture than they are part of the networks, right? They are there because they're there. Whereas some people that are more intentional about who they should connect to, they're much better connected. To me, in terms of connectivity, it's a lot about what is your intentional connectivity that you want to get to when you're in the office. So who is it that you should connect to about what, when, and why? And I think that is important. And I think where leadership fails right now is when a top CEO somewhere or a big leader says, we all need to be in the office 3 days per week. And then they leave it like that, because that is not going to give performance, I tell you. Because then people select their own days and they will not be connecting to the people they really need to. So I think leadership has to go a few more miles on this one before they find the right solution. And I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution.
Yeah.
You need to go in and look at your organization, or not the entire organization, but a group of people, and it's typically around 200 people or so, and look at what are the trade-offs we have in our group. What do we need to achieve? And when we know what we need to achieve, we can start to look at the days and who should be meeting about what and so forth. Maybe several days.
Already, right?
Yeah. No. So if we had this organization, financial organization we worked with, and it was clear that 0 days worked perfectly for the people in the shared services organization, that was actually the reason for being in the company. Just imagine you now tell them you all have to be in the office 3 days per week or whatever, because that's the corporate decision. Then you fail again.
And that speaks to that kind of top-down approach, doesn't it? Making decisions. And I would like to give leaders a bit of credit, desperately trying to do the right things, right? Yeah. that the outcomes they want are no different to what the people want, in my experience. Very few leaders are setting out to create these kind of challenging or difficult or fragmented or broken organizations. But it is that lack of connecting to the informal networks, and how you describe so beautifully what happens when you do speak to those people, get their buy-in, and then pivot based on their feedback. I think more importantly, maybe than even just activating them, because you talk a lot about activation, and I wanted to get some talking about that. But it's almost like once you activate them, you have to then also act on what they tell you, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we collect knowledge on that as well. If you activate them, but you're not listening to them or acting on what they say, right? Then you're failing, of course. You need to keep it going. And this is not, that's maybe book number three, I'm not sure. But we can also see that where a lot of companies, they actually fail is in the execution, right? In the final stages where they need to sustain the change, right? Where the leadership needs to stay on top of what this is. The project team needs to be set up on and so forth, right? What our numbers say right now is that it's around 20% that actually do that. Most others, they actually never get to that point.
Right. So two things come up for me with that. The first is sustain being the final part of the journey. What are the three, four steps that you have seen?
No, so we say identify the catalyst. So the informal catalyst, which are the 3%, right? Make sure you do that. And then if you don't want to run the evidence-based approach that we do, at least do yourself the favor that you ask people, who is it that you go to for help and advice? Who is it that gives you energy? Kind of make sure you ask people, right? Because you don't know. So that's really the first thing. The second thing is, how do you activate them? And when I say activate, I mean, you need to make sure they understand that they should be playing a part in your change, right? As I said before, done by the people and done with the people beats done to. And done by and with means co-creating and so forth, right? That a change is never won in the Excel sheet, right? It is won when you talk to people. So the activation, I've seen some people say, but then we send out an email and then that is done, right? and that's just not the way it works. I actually think that you need to do this by yourself, right? You need to talk to people. And sometimes, often it takes more than one conversation to make sure people are convinced. Okay, then we've got the engagement. The engagement is, if all goes well, is actually led by the informal catalyst, right? Because if they take ownership and they're ready to create with you or work with you, right? They actually do stuff for you. But your job is to make sure you kind of govern how much are they going to be used, because as their impact is seen by others, you'll be flooded with requests of people that want to work with it for everything, right? And so that's where you need to protect them a bit. Yeah, then the last thing is to sustain, because everything, as you also know, resistance builds up, people leave the company and so forth. I mean, reality, it's any change program, and you then need to make sure you actually sustain the focus over time. That's always the heart of the persistence, right?
I was just going to say, and that's my second question is, right, so you've done all the good stuff at the start. What is key to sustaining this movement?
Yeah, no, I know, and this is going back to this, maybe the sort of six change blockers. We see two of the six change blockers. One of them is, how do you retain ongoing leadership support for this? So that's really, really important, right? And to do that, you need to make sure you got the numbers. You need to be able to track and report, because that's the way the brain of most leaders work.
Mm-hmm.
With those numbers, you need to build the arguments for sustaining or moving on with your change program. The other thing that is important is, and that's also an error we often see, is that the project team that you've set up to deal with this, I mean, it falls apart. People move on. They want to do something. They have ambitions or whatever, right? So how do you make sure that the project team is set up for support or for success over time? And again, if you want to do that, you need the support of the leadership team. And it's not something that you do on the side, right? On top of everything else.
Yeah, it's not an addition to your day job, right?
No. I think the best cases we've seen, companies allocated people to do this, almost like a functional task, right? Rather than a project, it was more like change is ongoing. It's happening all the time. So it was almost like an
office. I love that. Like an office of change
thing. So you're setting up the expectation that change is going to be ongoing. And the expectation is also that there will be ongoing contribution to being part of that. Yeah.
Yes. And then you might have to switch out some of the people you're working with. Maybe they're leaving the company, whatever. And you need to have a mechanism for making sure you can replace it, right?
That's fantastic. So two other things. I mean, I could just talk to you all day and just download your brain because I love it. I really like this quote from the book that I just thought it was so impactful. Gravity is tempting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is a project we just worked with.
It hit me so hard. I wrote it down in quotation marks when I read it.
Yeah, it is. I'm just looking up because it's not that long ago. Maybe I can find it here in my notes. This is actually a project that is no more than 5 months old, right? And now we go back to the rockets again, right? It's a rocket analogy. We're not out of the atmosphere, but we have the rocket off the ground. Gravity is tempting. And yes, it is tempting, right? And that's where I talk about this thing where people set off to do something and then they just do not complete it. And there can be several reasons for that. And then the fun thing is that I wrote this post about that. That was prior to me thinking about the book, which was called something about the ostrich effect.
Okay.
And I thought actually that the ostrich effect was something for real, right? That ostriches actually put their head down when they're afraid or whatever. They don't. It's just a story. Isn't that crazy? So what they're actually doing is that they're digging for things. It's just a fairy tale. It's just not real. Anyways, we see that in organizations, right? Leaders that when they get the information, then suddenly they stop. They get to the identification. Oops, it's a Frenchman. It's someone we don't like. Let's see if we can find an excuse for not doing anything.
Right.
Otherwise, we would need to explain it, right? So that's where the gravity suddenly becomes tempting, right? Let's go down again.
It's a little too high. It's a little too scary, whatever that feels like. Yeah.
Exactly.
Is it a lack of commitment or a lack of motivation? Or do you think they get distracted by the next new shiny thing that's on the horizon or demanding their attention? Because leaders have lots of things going on all the time. And they're always expecting sort of updates and progress and da-da-da and da-da-da. So
I think it's a lack of focus because the plate is full and you want to do this and that and this and that and this and that. But what you really need to do is do this, but do it right. Focus, right? Make sure you know what is driving what we are trying to achieve and everything else that is not on this little plate here, right? You should forget about it. And that ability to focus like that, that is just not a key competency amongst the leaders that we see in many companies.
Does that mean that leaders are the wrong people to then lead the change?
No.
Obviously,
no.
They all have to have the buy-in and stuff, but like actually doing it and having it be something that moves forward?
I think leaders need to play a role in any change. Because they are important for the communication. So people see this is actually what we're trying to achieve. They're also important for the role modeling. And then they're important because they need to stay on top of it over time. So in that respect, I do think they are important. You cannot run a change program without leaders. So actually, again, if I look in the 6 change model research in book number 3, I'm not promising book number 3. I just want to make sure that
I'm going to buy it right now.
But it's a pre-order.
We actually know that there are two key stakeholder groups, right? And one of them is the leadership team, and the other one is the 3%. So those two stakeholder groups are of paramount importance to any change program that wants to succeed.
Amazing.
And that's, I think I told you already, I call them the early warning signals, right? They are not on board, forget it.
Just not worth it.
I know. You might as well stop. I think when you have the leadership team on board, right, and when you have this informal catalyst, the 3% on board, then you are in a position really to get off the ground and get moving. But it also means that make sure you get this in the right place, right, before you just accelerate. Because if you accelerate too soon and you've not really included them in the work, they're not on board with it, then resistance would build up. And I am not a really big fan of talking about resistance. I actually think you can accelerate your way in resistance by working with positivity. Go with the flow rather than go spending too much time on the negatives. I have this one case where we worked with a pharma company and we couldn't get this project off the ground because in all of the old countries, the old European countries of this company, right? There was so much resistance because they could see what you're trying to do with this company is going against our power in the organization, right? You try to build a network-centric organization, and that would go against our country power, really, right? And our program manager just couldn't move on. And then in the end, I said, well, maybe we should just forget about all those old countries and just show them, lead by example, show them what we can do if we just move on with all of those people that are really, really positive. They want to show us their support, right? Yeah. And then by getting that traction for the change program, the others came along, right? I see a lot of times we focus a lot on the negatives. I think we should focus on the positives, get the traction, and then the others would follow along.
I'm so glad you told that story. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's something like I've experienced. I didn't have the words to describe it, but what you've described is for me when things work and when they don't. That's just so clear is if we just turn away from that, we're not saying it's not there. We're not saying it's not happening. But actually, I'm going to go in and that idea of like creating the pocket of greatness, which I'm sure people have heard me say before, like go do that. And then people will start to pay attention and go, what is happening over here? Right? I love that. Yep. One last thing for me. Sorry, Jenny. I feel like I've asked all the questions. I've got a big full notebook from this morning that when I woke up and had my coffee. The Wakama rule, is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, it sounds like an Indian expression, right? So, but it's not. It's simply an abbreviation of when you need to engage with people, then do yourself the favor to walk to talk to the person. So the walk, WA. And if you cannot walk to them, then call them. That's the CA. Because they speak with your voice, right? And they can listen to whatever you say. And the very last option should be to write them in an email or a text message or whatever, right? I call it the Wakama ring. Always do it like that, right? And then I think that actually works for any engagement with all people, right? Always make sure you try to talk to them. And a virtual call, in my view, is somewhere between the walk and the call. Now, you asked me, and there is again some good research on that showing that a conversation face to face is 34 times more powerful than an email in convincing people, right? So, if I should say something, the change is not one in your Excel sheets, it's not one in your emails either. So, it's one when you actually talk to people and deal with people.
Just incredible. I've got so many things. So, how do people get to buy your book? Contact you. I mean, you're prolific on social media. We'll put all the links up. I think you were very generous and gave our listeners an offer, which we'll also post to the book. But how can people find you and get in touch?
I'm visible on social media. I'm active on LinkedIn and on Twitter under my name, Jeppe Hansgaard. You can also find all of the work of InnoWise. We do a lot of sharing of cases and learning and stuff. We do believe in this. We want to make this as a better world. I need to change it into a movement. So we share stuff all the time. So follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter are the two best ones. I know we have something going on Pinterest. I've never been on Pinterest myself, so I don't know what it is, to be honest.
Now I want to go find you on Pinterest.
I have a discount code that I gave to you for Thriving20. If you write that with a big T and then Thriving20, if we give you 20% off the books, you can buy the first books and you can pre-order the second book.
What if we find the third book, Yipit?
You can actually, when you buy the books, you can actually subscribe in the platform to hearing about new products. But you can also just follow me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty sure I'm going to talk about it if it happens. I was so proud, I tell you, when we actually released the book.
It's October
13, right? And then it hit me. October 13. I mean, who is releasing a book on October 13? Friday, October 13, to be honest. Yeah. We have something to learn here. It's gone well, but let's see. We can probably do better in the second time.
Well, you know what? It sounds like you did all the things, right? You went to your network, you found your catalysts, you activated what you needed to do. And then you just did it. And it sounds like you are going to sustain it. Without meaning to, you created your book through your own process.
That's actually a good observation. And I do agree with that. That is actually exactly what we're doing. And we do it again. We did our lessons learned on it. And we do know what will we do better the second time.
Amazing. I can't wait. I was one of those people who ordered both the books. And then I went, how come there's only one? Where is the second one? She went, I haven't written it yet. Oh, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you want to leave people with, a final thought or a summation?
Well, I can tell you that one really nice, two things. So two nice things I've heard about people that have read the book afterwards. One person, a professor, said that he had included in his MBA curriculum which I think is marvelous because that means that, okay, this is actually hitting an audience that I was not expecting. I think that is really nice. And then another one, which was a person that I didn't know. So now I was actually outside my own networks, so 3+ or whatever it's called on LinkedIn, a guy who out of the blue just wrote to me and said, I had more aha moments from this book than I could count. This is definitely going to change the way I do change. And that is just perfect for me.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I recommend it. It's chock full of things that you can do. I like to do things. So for me, it's such a fantastic book.
It's all those pieces.
Well, thank you.
One last thing. I was reading this other thing about people prefer dopamine over cortisol. So now when you say you could just do things, right? You like that, right? Do you know what I mean with that? That's like firefighting over diagnosing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's an issue, right? Maybe we should treat diagnosing a bit more than firefighting.
Yeah, I agree. I know that I do that. That's, yeah.
Hold the hand up.
What's the personal thing? And casual advice.
We'd like to say thank you again to Yipi for being with us once more. And we're so looking forward to having him back when we talk in greater depth about his second book and the one that's following after that. And meanwhile, if anybody's got any comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your thoughts about what you've heard on this session, because it is revolutionary. It is going to change management, and I think for the good as well. So thank you so much for being with us once more, and we look forward to having your company on the next session of Thriving with Sarah and Jenny. See you then. Bye.
See you. Bye-bye.